South Africa's political landscape is in flux. The old liberation parties are grappling with legitimacy, new alliances are reshaping the centre, and voters are searching for voices that sound like conviction, not convenience. In that noise, Vuyo Zungula stands out for being both familiar and unexpected, a young leader who speaks the language of faith, morality, and transformation. In today's episode, how does a values-based politics survive in a system built on power and pragmatism? And what drives a leader who still speaks of conviction in an age of calculation? This is ATM's Vuyo Zungula, up close, in context, and on Level Up. I hear you were talking at a conference.
Yeah, there's a conference on illicit financial flows. It's organized by Tax Justice Network Africa. So
Tax Justice.
Yeah. So there's MPs from across the continent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So there was a Mbeki report which was released in 2015, which detailed how much the continent is losing on illicit financial flows.
Mm.
So, yeah. So that's what the conference is about.
Ah, were you talking at the conference? And how was that?
It was okay. Like, you know, when you speak in parliament, you know you're going to be heckled. You know, usabuli sanje, you know they're going to come at you. But in these conferences, then you are able to relax more and focus on the content. But when you're in parliament, you just need to block out the noise.
Mm.
Because, you know, the problem there is that for us, we've got 3 minutes. You'll get there, usabulisa, they will try to distract you by heckling you. I remember, terribly got there. I think he said something, and Upemi Majodina, she was like chief whip at the time, she heckled him. Then he lost track of his speech. He focused on Upemi. Went at her, went at the ANC. And then...
Yeah, barely 3 minutes.
When he comes back to the speech, the speaker is like, hey, dade, nakoya how if a deal. So that's the issue with parties with a few seats, that you only have 3 minutes at most, and you need to make sure you use that 3 minutes properly. Mm.
You, a new entrant into the political arena and the youngest political leader, what was that like for you? So when you came into parliament in 2019, your party was formed in 2018, you contested and came into parliament.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
I needed to adjust, primarily because I was not in politics before. So it's unlike a person who was in student politics, youth league, nanani, was a councillor, MPL, and then went to parliament. For me, I came right from the community and straight to parliament. And my entire life, I've been observing how parliament operates. Now, when we went in, I needed to adjust to say, I'm not just watching at home, which is what is happening in parliament, but now I'm an active player. So that was the first thing. And the second thing I needed to realize is that initially I thought that parliament should be a space whereby there's going to be like an ideas-based platform, whereby it's just a battle of ideas in terms of how we can solve our problems. But when you get there, you realize, nope, you could have the right ideas, but the other parties will never allow a case whereby someone from another party seemingly is proposing ideas and they're accepted. So it's not a matter of whether one is right or wrong, but it's just a matter of which party do you belong to. And it seems as if most parties have got a posture 80. If whatever that comes from any member of our own party is correct, and whatever that is coming from any member of another party is incorrect. So it was disappointing to pick up, but that is the culture of our parliament, because it does impede on our ability as a country to really work together in service of our people.
And what is it that made you want to get into this politics? What are you hoping to achieve?
Change.
What? Change. That's political speak, because you sound like one of them now.
No.
Have you been transformed into one of them?
No. So what I mean by change is that we've been sitting from the sidelines, maybe being critical of the people that were the political players, to say this is what they are doing, this is what they should be doing, and, you know, criticizing what they do. But when I entered into the space, firstly, I was like, I'm not going to conform to their type of politics. So at a personal level, at a political level, I want to believe I do not even speak like a typical politician. I do not even live like a typical politician. I'm the same person that used to work in the private sector, do my own thing, etc. So what I mean by change is that we basically need in our country like a new type of political leadership, because it starts there. The policies, the programs of government can follow, but if you don't get the right mindset in terms of the people that are in power, then none of the policies will actually have a material difference, because the driver of these politics, the mentality has not changed.
So what does that new type of political leader look like for you? You come from your party comes from a caucus, essentially, of a lot of small Christian-based organizations, and that's how you formed yourselves. Are you a Christian organization? Do you see yourself as a Christian organization first? And what does that mean in a broad spectrum country with many different types of faiths and cultures like ours?
We define ourselves as a values-driven organization. You know, we've got values like peace, ubuntu, servant leadership, transformation, accountability, because those values, in our view, they bring all of us together. And we do know that there's different faiths in our country. There's African spirituality, there's Islam, there's Christianity. However, there is a common thread in all of these faiths that bring us together. So that's why we believe we view ourselves as a values-driven organization. So our view is to say, if we are values-driven, then we'll be able to do things differently. Because our view is to say, both at leadership level, as well as a citizen level, there's a destruction of our value system as Africans. Because if we had a value system like Ubuntu, for example, you would not have the people that are in power stealing the men in which they are stealing if they were driven by the values of Ubuntu. There is no way in which the crisis and corruption in Tembisa Hospital would happen if you had people with Ubuntu, leaders with Ubuntu. Similarly, at a community level, the crimes that we witness, it's not just a crime for the sake of having criminality, but there is an absence of a value system. That is why even communities are at war within themselves, because there is no values of Ubuntu. So that is why our view is to say, if we then become a values-driven society, then regardless of the socio-economic challenges, but our values, which is our anchor, will inform how we act, how we react, and how we basically relate to one another.
And how would you see that working? I mean, you have a position in the National Assembly. You have some representation in two legislatures in the Eastern Cape and KZN. How does that translate practically for you in your day-to-day work?
In terms of the work I do, which is in parliament or in the party?
In parliament, okay. Which is what impacts the people of South Africa. Then we can talk a little bit about the party.
Yeah, so in parliament for us, we are in two committees, which is employment and labor, mineral and petroleum resources. And because we are there, we then have to attend most of those committee meetings. However, because we only have two seats, and the problems that we face in our country sometimes requires interventions in terms of the health committee, police committee. So you find that we need to alternate between the different portfolio committees. And then at a community level, We need to interact with communities basically from all 9 provinces, because if a certain community in Lephalale, Limpopo reaches out to me to say, we've got this particular issue, can we have an engagement with you so we can, you can represent us in parliament, we need to avail ourselves. Also at a constituency level, we've got certain organizations or stakeholders that will come and say, we are representing the film and TV producers. We've got these particular issues. Can we have an engagement? So our work most of the time is cut across all of the different departments and sectors in our country.
And, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about showing up in conferences and some of the things that you do believe in. And you talk about integrity and a new type of leader and leadership. In your experience now, you're in a second administration in parliament, do you think that there is space for that kind of idealism to take root?
There is definitely space. However, the challenge is too much, because you find that most of the political leaders, they want to grow their parties, they want to make an impact in terms of the politics of our country. And sometimes that requires them not to operate at a principle level, but they need to think in terms of what is in their own selfish interests. If I can make an example, last term we had parties that were very critical of the ANC, saying they will never work with the ANC. However, come 2024, when the ANC is below 50%, you found those parties scrambling to work with the ANC, not because they genuinely wanted to work with the ANC and they believe the policies of the ANC. They just wanted to be in the executive because there's going to be access to power and access to resources. So there is space in terms of us being idealistic. But at the same time, the biggest challenge that we have is that majority of our politicians, they do not think about the greater good. They think about their own selfish interests as individuals, as well as their interest as the individual parties now. So that is why you find that what ideally want to achieve is constrained by those interests that trump the interests of the greater good of our country.
So you say that about the GNU and how it was formulated, and your own party is part of what's termed the Progressive Caucus.
Yeah.
Right? Is that not speaking with the forked tongue if you consider that the biggest party within the Progressive Caucus is led by one Jacob Zuma, and I mean many other leaders in that party are specifically named in many instances of corruption and malfeasance in this country. So are you not doing the same thing?
No, not at all. Firstly, if we are talking about corruption, perhaps we just need to move away from corruption being a media spectacle, whereby in the discussions in the media space, there's going to be utterances to say 1, 2, 3 has been named to be corrupt, etc. Because corruption is a crime. And because it is a crime, for one to say so-and-so is corrupt, there must be a court judgment to that effect to say you stole X amount of money or you embezzled X amount of money and therefore you were deemed to be corrupt by a competent authority, which is our courts. Now, once you have a case whereby corruption is just a case whereby someone writes a media article and it ends there, we'll never defeat corruption. So it's totally different things. Whereas if you look at what these parties were saying, put aside the corruption allegations, most of these parties were saying the policies of the ANC will never move the country forward. They were talking about how compromised some of the leaders of the ANC. But to have them fight and scramble to work with the very same organization they were fighting against, in my view, it speaks to a lack of principle. Now, the Progressive Caucus, is basically a caucus of different political parties that agree to work together towards certain policy positions that we agree on. Hence, you find that if you look at the formation of the GNU, one of the things that we criticized the ANC on was to say, but where is the program of action in terms of the GNU, what it wants to achieve for the next 5 years? Because a government is there for about 5 years. And in that 5 years, you don't just wake up and say, okay, what? You don't form a government and then ask, what are we going to do? You ideally need to say, given what the status of the country is now, this is what we want to do to solve the problems of unemployment, crime, poverty, etc. These are the programs. And then you look at the policies of the different political parties. Once you find commonality, you then say we can work with these parties to achieve, to implement these programs in order for us to solve these problems. However, like what we see now, you've got the ANC and the DA in the very same government. The ANC advances employment equity. The DA goes to court against employment equity. The ANC advances the Expropriation Act. The DA goes to court against Expropriation Act. The ANC says there needs to be NHI. The DA goes against that. So what does that speak to when it comes to the coherence of the government? Look at, for example, even when it comes to international relations, the foreign policy of the ANC and the DA, completely opposite. So that is why it became difficult at a principle level to say you are going to be joining a GNU without any direction in terms of what needs to be done and and the programs, therefore, that need to follow when it comes to once a government has been established.
So I think it's well ventilated where the ANC and the DA and those people stand on various policies. I would like to hear a little bit more about what you believe needs to happen, what your policies are. What do you think needs to change? And how do we go about changing that to make South Africa better?
Our country is facing various and multiple problems, both at a structural level and at service delivery practical level. Therefore, the solutions either will be long-term, will be short-term, etc. Now, there are certain key priorities from our side to address the problems that we have. The first one is to say, even though we want to completely bring about a new South Africa when it comes to the legislative framework from the constitution to the policies that follow. However, at an immediate level, poverty and unemployment are the biggest obstacles that we have towards South Africa really fulfilling what the constitution currently says, which is the right to dignity. Now, hence we're advancing that poverty and unemployment should be declared a national disaster. We say this particularly because if you look at how a national disaster operates, firstly, it brings about different departments, brings about different stakeholders in the form of the private sector, civil society, to really zoom in on that particular disaster and invest or coordinate resources towards addressing that particular disaster. So on the question of unemployment and poverty, ours is to say if you are going to have over 11 million people being unemployed in our country, that is close to a quarter of our workforce, and you are going to have over 55% of the people living below the poverty line, it's a disaster. And this is not just stats, it's not just figures, it's not just numbers, but it is human suffering. Because if you go to any township, any village whereby a person is unemployed, a person is in poverty, that is human suffering. I remember in my hometown Ekuwa, there's actually a mother who poisoned her kids and herself precisely because she could not deal with having to beg every day to feed their family. So that is why our view is to say, once poverty and unemployment is declared a national disaster, then it will enable the government to really fulfill what the Constitution requires, which is the right to dignity for all citizens. And the Constitution currently does allow the government to take any extraordinary measure to bring about that. You recall that during the time of COVID-19, there was a national disaster. The entire focus at that particular period was to say, how then do we overcome this disaster of COVID-19? There was briefings from each and every department. Small business would come there and say, okay, the Department of Health has given these regulations. Therefore, this is what we are going to do as a small business in response to these regulations that are set out to address this crisis of COVID-19. But when it comes to unemployment and poverty, it becomes only political speech. You're going to have the president saying he's shocked at the level of poverty and unemployment, or he's going to ask questions, why should we have so many people living in poverty? He's not, as a president, actually taking action. So that is why for us, our call to say it must be declared a national disaster, because it is a crisis, but not a crisis that must only be spoken about in political speech and rhetoric, but it must translate into tangible action so that the person, emakhaya, knows and feels, okay, the government understands and feels my frustration.
Well, you talk about poverty and poverty alleviation and needing to categorize it as a national crisis. And at the same time, though, you have been very vocal about, and the people at the front line of dealing with that tend to be non-NGOs, right? NPCs and NGOs. And you've been very vocal about the fact that we have many NGOs and they're foreign funded and this is problematic. So how then do you see the opportunity of attracting the right kind of investment if you're vocal against NGOs and not wanting to see foreign-backed NGOs operating in the space of poverty alleviation? How then do you see attracting the right kind of investment without losing the autonomy of your country as you see it?
The issue we have with NGOs, it is we've got an increase in the influence of NGOs in our country. Now, this influence somewhat is a problem to our democracy, because our democracy should be informed by the will of the people. Hence, people go to elections. People take part in public participation processes of parliament. However, the influence of foreign-funded NGOs, it is precisely to influence the government programs and policies on a number of issues. If we can zoom in on what is currently happening in the oil and gas sector in our country, I can make a few examples. One of them is an NGO called Green Connection, which went to court to block the exploration in the south coast of gas deposits that were found in that particular part of our country. Now, when you trace now this particular NGO, who is the fund of this NGO? It is funded by Ocean 5. Ocean 5, it is an international NGO that then uses their resources to fund Green Connection. Green Connection, who then goes to court to litigate against the government, against any form of oil and gas exploration in South Africa. The mandate of Ocean 5, if you go to their website, is very clear to say, block any form of oil and gas exploration all over the world. Now, the issue we have there is that we can't then have foreign-funded NGOs directing or dictating the direction in which the country must take, because South Africa has got a right to basically extract its minerals. Just like other countries go to the Middle East, they've got their minerals, which is the oil, and they're extracting those minerals, and there's no poverty in majority of those countries. But come to South Africa, there's going to be minerals found, however, foreign-funded NGOs. So it's a completely different topic if a community, an authentic community, saying they do not want this particular project, and they've not been influenced or funded by a foreign entity. But once you have a foreign-funded NGO using their resources to influence South Africa through litigation against any form of development, because if we extract our resources in South Africa, there's going to be a decrease in terms of unemployment. We are going to, in this particular case, deal with the energy insecurity problems that we have. But once we are at the mercy of foreign-funded NGOs, it is problematic, especially when it is foreign ideologies that now are imported to South Africa via foreign-funded NGOs to influence the policy directions of our country.
But, you know, so where do you find the balance? Where do you find the balance where you have communities that are hungry, starving, poor, and you're trying to get investment? So we understand that even as a country, right, we need foreign investment, whether it is in NGOs or whether it is in big business. Where do you find the balance, in your view, between the two?
South Africa should be guided by our national interests. And our national interest should be informed by what is the socio-economic status of our country. So if it is in our interest, for example, to continue mining coal, we must continue mining coal. The amount of coal that we have in our country is more than enough to last us 400 years. And it is a resource that we must continue mining. Now, once you've got foreign-funded NGOs that will go to court to stop the mining of coal in our communities, we should be worried to say, is that foreign-funded NGO operating in line with our national interest? So the point of departure, South Africa should look, and the government should have a posture that says what is in our national interest, and everything else must come from there. And we must learn from countries like Namibia, because in Namibia, they extract their resources in line with what they want to do for their own people. And they are not allowing foreign-funded NGOs to dictate the agenda of what they can or cannot do in their country. However, in South Africa, perhaps the issue is also with our constitution, because Section 24 of the constitution says everyone has got a right to a particular environment, etc., etc. So that allows even foreign-funded NGO to go to court and litigate, because that everyone statement in the constitution basically allows everyone, because everyone is everyone. However, if you were to compare the South African constitution when it comes to the environment with the Namibian constitution, you find that Article 95 of the Namibian constitution is very clear to say it is a state that has got the responsibility of providing a conducive environment for its citizens. Meaning, you won't find a foreign-funded NGO in Namibia taking the Namibian government to court precisely because they've got a certain issue with the environment. Whereas in South Africa, it is too open. That is why it allows everyone to, to litigate against the government. And I'm bringing about the question of the environment because it is what these foreign-funded NGOs use. They block any form of development in our country under the guise of the environment. Whereas if you read their mandates is very clear, is to block oil and gas development. But they will not say how, but they will find loopholes. So what we're then saying that the government has had about 31 years to understand what have been the loopholes in terms of our constitution or our legislative framework that blocks or impedes the ability of the government to deliver the promises to its people. Therefore, let it address such loopholes and not just allow a case whereby you are going to be dictated to by foreign-funded NGOs.
So, you know, you talk about national interest and you talk about putting South Africa and the national interest of South Africans first. What, in your view, is the reason why it has been so hard for smaller parties such as yourselves who talk this national interest to get the interest of the voters aligned with you so that you can become bigger parties. What's the gap that people are not hearing? Because it sounds like you're making all the right noises, right? You're saying, we care about the community, we care about employment, we care about poverty. So where do you think the misalignment for people is? Why is it difficult for small parties who say these things to grow into bigger parties?
It's not a misalignment between the parties or the ATM and the citizens. It's just a matter of the political system in our country is very expensive. You may have the right ideas, speak in a manner that the people understand, but to run an election campaign requires a lot of money. Hence, you find most parties, when you look at the IEC declarations, they'll receive in excess of 50 million. If you look at the declarations from most of these big parties, it is quite a big, substantial number, which comes from certain groupings or companies or individuals to influence government policy. Now, the issue with parties that are truly, genuinely for the people is that you can't receive money from the same institutions or companies that are profiting from the problems that we have, and you think that you are truly going to advocate and advance the interests of the people. So there'll always be misalignment between private interests and public good. Now, the private interests, they'll fund political parties for the sole reason of using those political parties to protect their private interests. Now, what is in the public good will never align with the interests of those private interests. So the issues that we face is that you may have the right ideas, have the right set of leaders or people to take those ideas. But for you to actually run an effective campaign, you need so many millions. Hence, most of these parties, they realize that and then they go back to the very same private interests. They get money there and that's how they become compromised. Because it is my view to say South Africans are judging political parties not in the right context. And the context in which they're judging political parties now, it is what they say in rallies, what they say in the media. But they do not really scrutinize what are these parties actually saying in and doing in parliament, because that is where it matters the most. And in parliament, most of these parties, for example, they'll talk about, let's say, land expropriation without compensation. But when you really check in parliament, are they advancing the very same issues that they're advancing in the media? The answer is no. So to answer your question, most parties then take a decision to say, are we going to be true to South African citizens, be genuine in terms of what we say, and not have the money that big business gives to certain political parties? Or are we going to compromise and go to big business and receive these funds and resources that are needed to run successful campaigns, but at the same time compromise the interests of our people? So ATM, fortunately, has chosen the side of the people instead of the side of capital.
But it sounds to me like you're also saying, by choosing that side, you really have no prospects of growth. So then my question to you is, what's the point?
No, there is definitely prospects of growth, because South Africans have been waking up to understand how much the funding of political parties impedes the ability of the parties they vote for when it comes to being represented in parliament. Unlike a case whereby the issue of people understanding the link between who funds you and the ability of a party to actually commit and fulfill its electoral promises. They did not understand that link. But now we have more and more South Africans understanding that when you vote for a party, you're not only voting for that particular party, but you are also voting for the interests of the person that is funding that political party. So there is definitely growth because people are now waking up and realizing that these compromise parties will never take them anywhere. Rather, let us struggle and suffer, but at the same time, we are definitely going to make it in future, instead of just allowing parties that are compromised to be at the helm of running our country.
So talking about your party then, do you see growth within your party? And what kind of prospects do you see in the coming elections for your party?
There's definitely growth. The amount of organizations, institutions that we've been engaging on a weekly basis has been something else. This past weekend, we were Kumkubo Mahlubi in Escort, KZN, and we're precisely invited there because the nation of Mahlubi saw that we are representing them in parliament, because we're the only party that was advancing that Mahlubi must be recognized as a nation in our country. The king of Mahlubi must be having the status of being a king and not as per the government. And there's also other institutions and organizations that equally have been very positive towards the work that we do in parliament. So hence, earlier on, we spoke about the balance that we need to have between the work that we do in terms of the parliament processes and connecting with the electorate via different stakeholders, different groupings. So the work that we've been doing in parliament has been attracting such community organizations or such stakeholders in the communities to say they are going to put their vote behind ATM.
So if we were to talk a little bit about the personal part of we, and you talked about how you did not grow up in politics or student politics, but actually through work in the private sector to get to where you are. What would you say you have had to give up to be able to do this work of building a political party and hoping to fix the country?
You need to give up a lot of things. For example, the issue of you can't live life the way you want to live.
What does that mean?
Like this, you know, as a leader, there's certain expectations.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, if a certain leader, I'm not going to, you know, make an example about myself. Now, let's say there's a certain leader in our country. Let's say, hypothetically, his name is Usia. Usia wants to go clubbing. He can't go clubbing, because with the people that follow him, maybe they do not associate clubbing, drinking, with leadership, Hence, you find that if you see on social media, the people that are leaders in our country trending because they were drunk, they get backlash, So society has got certain standards, and you as a leader, you need to, you need to meet those standards. Even though if you look at how other people live, when people in our communities, let's say, engage in alcohol, it's no problem. It's fine, but leaders can't do that. So I'm talking about Usia, not anyone else. No, not anyone else. I'm talking about the leader called Usia. But even at a relationship level, you find that you sacrifice so much because you need to commit yourself to the political work. You have to be in parliament. You need to go to communities. You need to go to international conferences. So you spend most of your time doing political work, and that requires time away from loved ones. So the sacrifices that people don't really understand when it comes to what we have to do as people in the political space.
And so what would you say you have learned now, having been in the noise and heckling of parliament about power and how it is used in this country?
Power corrupts. Once you are in power, you get to have access to resources, you get to determine who gets what, you might be corrupted. And what I've learned is that you just need to stay true to South African citizens. And most importantly, you know, if we would have leaders who understand that to serve people is a calling, it is a calling whereby people or the leaders need to always guard what they do, guard their conscience, guard their actions and their words, because it is an honor and a privilege to serve South African citizens. Then you will not allow power to corrupt you. You will not allow power to actually change who you are as a person. There's people who join parliament immediately when they are known to be members of parliament. They change in terms of their attitude. Baba ngabantu abaphakamileyo. They can't, even they move from
honorable members.
They move from where they used to live and then they start living in different places. They change even their wardrobes because, you know, they want to meet a certain status, whereas it should not be about that. You know, at a local government level, you've got issues whereby a person will be elected to be a councillor, Soweto, but immediately gets to be elected as a councillor, he moves from the ward that he lives in and goes live in another, I could say, upmarket community. So it power changes people. So what I've learned is that do not allow power to change you. Rather, stay true to your principles, stay true to your values. And you might be tempted because it's very easy in South Africa for people to want fame. But the fame that comes with selling your principle will be short-lived. But once you stay principled, it will take time because people do not really, most of the time, align with principled people or principled leaders. But once it takes time, you'll be able to cement yourself in the hearts and minds of South African citizens.
I've never asked anyone this question, but I've been thinking a lot about what history looks like, looking back at what people have done. And so you're the first one to have to answer this question. In 10 years' time, what would you like South Africans to say, Vuyo Zungula has done this and changed our country or the trajectory of our country? What would you like that to be?
Earlier, we spoke about how ATM is more of an issue-driving organization. We deal with issues. You see, the politics of personalities as zingenezozinde because they do nothing for our people. So we'd like to be remembered or recognized as a party that has dealt with the issues that are problematic to the people. Hence, you find that when we are driving issues, we are looking at what is the current problems in our country, and then how do we drive the solutions in terms of the issues to say unemployment and poverty, then let's make it an issue that will not be ignored to an extent whereby it becomes only political speech, but it must be an issue that will require coordination from all of the departments, the private sector, civil society to address this particular problem of unemployment. There could be another issue that may come maybe next year or something, but we just need to keep on adapting and driving those issues for the solution instead of just existing in the political space. And you find that after X number of years in parliament, you then don't really recognize, okay, but what has ATM addressed in this particular term? You'll recall that in the first 5 years in parliament, we drove the issue of the prioritization of South African citizens. If you look at it now, it is something that even the ministers of employment and labor are driving in terms of their particular department. Even in small business, you are finding even the minister coming closer to what we've been advocating. We address the issue of accountability. We push for accountability in the parliament, in the UAE plane that landed in Ebisho in the Eastern Cape. So amongst others, there's so many issues that people can say we as the ATM have contributed towards the body politic in between 2019 and 2024. Currently, at the top of our agenda, it is declaring unemployment and poverty a national disaster. It is the fight against counterfeit and fake goods that are destroying our economy, because that is another issue that South Africans are not really looking into. You'll recall that there were kids that died from consuming counterfeit products in the spazas. Go to small street now, you are going to find a fake Maxhosa. And people, maybe hypothetically, leaders like Hosea will go to small street, buy the Maxhosa there, not really understanding the impact.
Oh, they're not buying it from small streets. They have the money to buy the real Gucci.
No, hypothetically. hypothetically, Hosea will buy from small street and not really understand the implications when it comes to how counterfeit products are actually destroying the economy and livelihoods. So it is something that is ignored when it comes to our country. And the last issue for now, it is the issue of ensuring that we protect our sovereignty from foreign-funded NGOs that are not operating in South Africa for the interests of South Africans, but they're operating in South Africa to advance their own ideological interests, which makes South Africa basically a colony of foreign-funded NGOs.
Sure. It's a lot. And good luck. I mean, I think it's commendable that a young person such as yourself decided, I want to be part of the solution. I want to do something different, and this is how I'm going to do it. And I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate you coming to chat with us today. I found this very fascinating discussion. I'm really interested. And I'll be looking forward to seeing what your numbers, how your numbers do in the local elections coming up next year and in our next national election.
Thank you so much. And you know, the point about being part of the solution, perhaps if we can look at pre-1994, there was a high level of political consciousness. You know, people were not disassociating themselves from politics. If you were talking about boycotts, marches, protests, people were there to say, we are fighting for freedom. Mandela must be freed. You must vote. People knew exactly this is what the problem is in our country, and this is collectively what we need to do to fix the country back then. But I think one of the issues that we face after 1994, people became deassociated with politics, disillusioned with politics, to an extent whereby they're not really understanding that politics is not only about voting. It is everything when it comes to our lives. And whether we like it or not, what is happening in our politics impacts the type of lives we are living and what our children will be 10, 20 years from now. So therefore, we just need to be, all of us, to be engaged to say, how do we shape the country that we would want to live in and the country that would want to live for our children? It does not require for each and every person to be a member of a political party, but it requires some level of commitment to say, if we do not work, or if you as an individual do not do anything when it comes to shaping how the country is, who are you leaving that to? Who are you hoping that will maybe resurrect from the dead to create the country that you want to live for your children? And I want to blame people who are parents, because you can't be a parent and not care about the future of our country. And not caring about the future of our country means you do not take part in voting. You are not aware of your political choices. You do nothing, to even educate your children about where we come from as a country and what we need to do now in terms of getting our country right. So perhaps what I would say to your listeners and the people who watch the podcast is to say, let's do something. as an individual, as a community, and as a country. Mm. But let's really stand up and shape the direction in which the country we want it to take, because at the end of the day, our children, they're not going to judge the other political leaders. Your children are going to judge you. You can complain and say, hi, but these political party leaders did 1, 2, 3. But your child will ask you, but mama, wena, what did you do?
Mm.
So you need to be able to say, Mdanam, this is what I did when we're faced with these challenges. But if you are going to be a person that is ignorant, you don't know anything that is happening in our country, you are not just compromising yourself, but you are actually condemning your child to a life of unemployment, poverty, drugs, lack of service delivery. All of these problems that we see now, they are only going to increase if South Africa does not change its direction. But if you want to really change the direction of our country, it starts with you.
That is a great place to end. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.